We had a party last week, an 18th birthday party. Yeah, it was mine. No, it was for Richard, and some of you attended, or some of your children perhaps. And Judy and I were led to observe that 18th birthday parties have changed a bit since we were 18. Some things were the same, of course. Despite rumours to the contrary, the music was just as deafeningly loud in 1960s as it is today. And teenagers still wear the strangest clothes, just like we did in the 1960s, although they're different. I still have a photo of my blousy shirt and the trousers with the huge bell bottoms from about that age. But other things are different today. In the first place, it really was a 21st birthday party. In the 21st century, 18 is the new 21. In the second place, no one plays games at these parties anymore. Not that this is necessarily a bad thing. I think our party games were often rather cringe-inducing. Certainly, the memory of some of them is quite cringe-inducing, so maybe that's an advance. But the third thing that we observed is that we hired a security guard. Never in my life before have we held a party where it was felt necessary to hire a security guard. Now, since this party was mostly attended by your children, we did not really need a security guard. No one misbehaved. Well, not that I'm going to mention to any parents present anyway. And, of course, no one gate-crashed. The security guard just stood around all night and policed the line beyond which an alcoholic beverage could not be consumed. And since more than half the people attending were not drinking alcoholic beverages, this was no arduous duty. Yet, if you know anything about teenage parties in the 21st century, you will know that everyone hires a security guard. What's happening to our world that you need security at a private party? And why is it happening? Well, I think most people will say that it's because the world is more dangerous than it used to be. We all seem to agree that there's more violence in the world than 10 or 20 years ago. There's more violence, so we need more protection. There are more gate-crashing stabbings, which means we need more security guards. Is that right? Is the world more violent than it used to be? Is violence increasing? It certainly seems so. But why is it so? Well, we used to have something in the world, a mechanism, that took violence out of the world. But the mechanism isn't working as well as it used to. And that gives rise to two questions. What is that mechanism? And why isn't it working? Well, you know, I know, that a social group, a community, can purge itself of internal conflict or violence by finding an external adversary or an enemy or an internal troublemaker. In other words, a community can unify itself by directing its violence against someone from within who is worthy of being killed or expelled as the source of all of its problems, or an external adversary, an enemy, who needs to be resisted or fought off. Now, most of us would agree that this is true because we know it from our own life experience. The fact that anthropologists have voluminous evidence for this mechanism at work down the centuries is simply verification for what we know in our own experience of the world. The best way to unify a group is to identify a common enemy and to scapegoat that enemy, blame that enemy. So in organisations you have the marketing department always blames the engineering department for everything's wrong, right? Or maybe it's the finance department. Everybody knows it's their fault, except the finance department, who accuses the production department of simply not following the accounting rules. Or, if you can remember, Britain was never so unified as when it was fighting the Germans. Well, it turns out that this mechanism rejuvenates and unifies all kinds of communities. It works in families, it works in church committees, it works in tennis clubs, and it works in multinational organisations, it works in nations, and I suspect it works in planets. You can create unity and peace within your family, or committee, or a nation, so long as you have someone against whom you can vent your hostility. The way this mechanism works, the anthropologists show us, is that the hostility of or violence within the individuals of the community is exported or drained off into the one that they find to be despicable or evil or a threat. So the world had a mechanism for dealing with violence and hostility, and the mechanism is what we call scapegoating. But it's not working as well as it used to. Now, the fact that we have a name for this mechanism tells us something about it. If you can put a label on something, it shows that you know something about it already. For example, snow. In English, we have one word for snow and a few adjectives, like powder snow. But the Eskimos have 15 words for snow. Now, some people will tell you they have 400 or 1,000, but that's an urban myth. There are only 15. But even having 15 words for snow is impressive, and it shows that the Eskimos know a lot more about snow than the English. Why? Well, they have so much of it compared to the English. If you can put a label on something, it shows that you know something about it. And if we know something about it, when we understand it well enough to be able to name it, then there's a good chance it's not going to work as well as it did before, when we were ignorant about it. For example, when telephone sales began to intrude into our homes, most of us were nice to the people who called. Even if they interrupted our evening meal, we would politely listen to their sales spiel because it sounded so authentic. "Hello, Mr. Hunt." "Oh, she knows my name. She must be a nice person." "We understand you're interested in making profitable investments." "Why, yes. I was interested in being a good investor. How did she know that?" "We have some marshland in Corio to sell you if you'll just sign up right away." "Wait a minute, this sounds a bit dodgy." But nowadays, of course, we know what this is and we have a name for it. We call it telemarketing. Well, actually, most of us have some rather more colourful names for it, but I won't mention those in church. But the point is that we recognise that we're being manipulated by a clever sales technique, and they get cleverer and cleverer, don't they? But as we recognise that we're being manipulated, the manipulation, the telemarketing, loses its effect. We say, "This is a sales pitch." And as soon as we name it, it stops working, and we say, "Thank you, goodbye," and hang up. Of course, most of us have got to know this particular mechanism, telemarketing, so well that now as soon as we hear an Indian accent on the phone, we hang up. Which, I wish to point out, can be a little embarrassing if it's Ivan Rashire calling to find out what time the practice is on. So the fact that we have a name for scapegoating already tells us that it doesn't work as well as before we had a name for it. It only works well if you don't know what you're doing. And now I'm going to tell you something about the Bible that I suspect most of us don't know. And that is that unique among world religions, the Judeo-Christian scriptures reveal the scapegoating mechanism from the beginning. Indeed, the reason that this mechanism works less and less well in the world is that God has revealed it to us. And God has shown us what's going on. He has given us eyes that see and ears that hear. This mechanism is first revealed to the world in the Old Testament. That is, it's first given a name, the name scapegoating. And it's in Leviticus chapter 16, verse 8. The mechanism itself has been in the world from the beginning, but it is the Christian and Jewish revelation that reveals it. And unique to our Bible among religious writings, the mechanism is named and revealed long before the people of the Old Testament could understand it. It's revealed to a pre-Christian world that could not understand it in the same way that the idea of loving your neighbour was revealed. As Tom reminded us last week, God reveals these truths about the world and his kingdom long before Jesus, long before the event that could help us to understand. So, scapegoating was revealed to the world a long while ago. But have we stopped scapegoating? No. It's worse than ever. It's not working, though. The power of scapegoating to drain away hostility in society is weaker and weaker with every passing day. If you go back a few hundred years and you scan the books and papers and writings of the time, you'll find the word violence occurs much less often than it does today. Today, it's everywhere. Why is that? Is there more violence than before? Are teenage parties more dangerous than 40 years ago? Actually, I'm not sure that it is. I think it's because we see more violence than we did a few hundred years ago. Last year, at the end of the year, I read the report of the United Nations Human Security Centre. It shows, very much to my surprise, that armed conflict in the world has been in steady decline for the last 50 years. That the world is a much safer, less violent place than it has ever been. Surprised? I was. Now, you know, I'm reading through the Old Testament at the moment, a few chapters a day, following on from Gavin's suggestion a few months back. And last week I actually came across the story of Jephthah. You all know the story of Jephthah? Well, I don't think I had ever heard of Jephthah before. I certainly had not read this. It was a great, surprising and wonderful discovery. Here were some verses in the Bible on which no human being appears to have ever preached in my presence before. So that was a fascinating discovery. But straight after Jephthah is the story of Samson. And I discovered that I'd forgotten more about Samson than I remembered. Man, what a violent dude this guy is. He makes Rambo look like a pussycat. He kills a lion while he's a teenager. Actually, he doesn't just kill it, he tears it to pieces. His first wife deceives him, so he goes off and kills 30 men at Ashkelon just to take their clothes. Apparently this is an early version of Norman Mailer's The Naked and the Dead. When he decides to burn down the Philistines' cornfields, he catches 300 foxes and sets their tails alight and lets them run through the fields, which causes the local community to go round to his first wife's family and burn them all to death. Now, I wonder why they did that. Well, in response to this event, the Bible says, he fell on them for all he was worth and caused great havoc. Sounds like English understatement, doesn't it? You know, and caused great havoc. Oh, chaps. What a havoc over there, Samson's calling. Anyway, all this goes on and on for a couple of chapters. But you know, the word violence appears nowhere. Indeed, the tone of the whole discussion, the whole narrative, is one of moral justification. Samson is the good guy. He's administering justice to the Philistines, and presumably to the foxes too, although I don't quite understand that. Well, why did Samson not see his actions as violent, and what stopped him from seeing it? Well, the violence that we don't see is the violence that is just, the violence that is necessary, the violence that is appropriate to the situation. If you went back in time to an Aztec priest, and as he's tearing the heart out of his human sacrifice and holding it up at the high altar to the sun god, and you said to him, "Excuse me, old chap, this seems like a rather violent act," he would have no idea what you're talking about, because for him it would make no sense to call that ritual, that human sacrifice, that bloody act, violence. The word violence as we use it today would not apply at that time and for him, nor would it have applied in 19th century Britain for hanging somebody who was guilty of some dreadful crime. And even today, there are plenty of people who embrace what I might see as violent scapegoating, and they do so without any of the moral awareness that I might bring to the event. About 9 years ago, I drove up from North Ossetia towards Chechnya in what had recently been Soviet Russia, and we went to a town to visit a group of doctors who were trying to set up a clinic because the Russian medical system had completely broken down. And when we arrived, we were greeted with a distraught medical team. Their chief surgeon had been murdered that morning. Why? Because he was the victim of a revenge killing. A patient had died during surgery, and the family of the patient killed the surgeon in revenge. In that society, in the late 20th century, justice still demanded an eye for an eye, a life for a life. The surgeon was the perfect scapegoat for their anger and grief. Did they think they were unjustly violent? Well, frankly, I don't know, because I never talked to the murderer. But I'd be willing to bet that the murderer felt no guilt at the time. One would hope that in a society that was ever so lightly touched by the Christian gospel, that there might be some kind of moral hangover a few days later. But back in the first century, do you think the people who crucified Jesus knew that what they were doing was scapegoating violence? No. Jesus asks God to give them specifically, to forgive them specifically, because they do not know what they are doing. And Caiaphas is on record as providing the perfect formulation of the scapegoating mechanism. He says in John 11:50-52, "It is better for you that one man die for the people to bring them together and make them one." Caiaphas, the perfect formulation of scapegoating violence. Caiaphas knew the world's rules so well, he had no idea what he was doing. Jesus spoke in parables to the people because, in his words, they had eyes that could not see and ears that could not hear. The world's ways are so hardwired into us that we often don't see what we're doing. In fact, I doubt a day goes by in my life that Jesus doesn't look down at me from heaven and says, "Father, forgive Philip," because he doesn't know what he's doing. My daily prayer is that God will give me eyes that can see and ears that can hear. So where does this leave us? Well, I guess after all that stuff, I need to remind us that we're actually working through some aspects of John's first letter. And today's message is the fourth in a series that began with Brian inviting us to walk in the light. And then Gavin asked us to obey Christ fully. And last week, Tom said we needed to love the family. This week's theme is reject worldly ways. Reject worldly ways. Which is why I've been talking so much about how the world works. How can we reject the ways of the world if we don't know how the world works? How can we avoid falling into the behavioural traps of the world if we don't have eyes that can see the traps and ears that can hear? In today's reading, John says, "You must not love this passing world or anything that is in the world. Because nothing the world has to offer," then he gives three examples, "the sensual body, the lustful eye, pride in possessions, none of these could ever come from the Father, but only from the world. And the world, with all it craves for, is coming to an end. But anyone who does the will of God remains forever." Now, John could not be clearer in his call to us to reject worldly ways. But there's a problem. You see, if we are ignorant about the way the world works, how can we know what to reject? If we have eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear, we'll think John's only writing about his three examples, sex and materialism. After all, he specifically mentions these things, lust and possessions. But clearly, there is more to it than that. John says we are not to love anything that is in the world. And he points out that the world is coming to an end. Does that mean sex and possessions are coming to an end? I don't think so. John is telling us what it is that will not come to an end, and that is the will of God. It is the will of God that will last forever. Which is why Gavin spoke so eloquently about being obedient. But let's not trivialise God's will by saying that it's just simply about being responsible when it comes to sex or possessions. These might be important things, but they are very much less than all of the good news. Now, rejecting the world's ways requires us to understand how the world works and then to apply our understanding to the way God works in his world, replacing scapegoating with forgiveness, replacing hostility with love of the enemy, replacing the desire for possessions with a desire for worship, replacing lies with truth, replacing the desire for power with the desire for personal sacrifice. Well, how might we develop eyes that can see and ears that can hear? In order to fully reject the ways of this passing world, we really need to develop a new sensibility. We need to be able to see our culture as we have never seen it before. We need to get outside of our world and see it from a new perspective. How does one do that? Well, here are four ways that I think might be helpful. First, take an opportunity to live outside the culture of your birth. The opportunity to live cross-culturally is one of the best ways to help us realise just how much our sense of right and wrong is right or wrong. But I don't mean travel. Travel's fine, but when we travel, we tend to travel with our culture in our suitcases and we don't really live cross-culturally. I mean live cross-culturally. Go live in another country. Get your passport first. Speak to anyone who's lived in Australia, who's come to live in Australia from another country. Most of them will tell you how learning to live in the Australian culture helped them to critique and examine the culture they left behind. So go and live in another country for 2 years at least, and preferably before you're 40. It's probably too late after that, because I think by then our cultures are pretty much hardwired into us. So parents, if your children take 2 years off to go and live in China or America or somewhere, I'm to blame. Second, if you can't get out of one culture for 2 years, try to get out of it one day a week. Attend church regularly. But when we come into church, let's make a conscious effort to leave the world behind. Don't bring the world in here. It doesn't belong. Worship is an otherworldly experience, or it ought to be. Let us not worship like the world expects we should worship. This is not a television program. This is not a football match. The rules of worship are made in heaven. They're not made on earth. Now, you probably know I like things to be well organised. I like to practice. I like things to run properly and in good order. I married a Presbyterian, after all. Actually, did you notice that on Wednesday Mrs. Hunt was on the front page of The Age? Mrs. Hunt stands by her man. Judy was delighted. I was delighted too. I'm not related to Rex. Have been mistaken for him once or twice, but not. Anyway, I like things. Must have been the fish kissing that gave it away. So I like things to run properly. I like to rehearse. But as much as I like high production values, worship is not about high production values. I remember organising an introductory worship service for an international conference in the Philippines, and it took weeks of organising and a whole day to rehearse, and it went off without a hitch. It was a wonderful production success. And afterwards, I was talking to a lovely Swiss priest who specialised in meditation and reflection, and I asked him how he thought it went. Now, he knew I was pleased with what we had done, and he said, "Very tight, I'd say, no room for the Holy Spirit at all." So take advantage of worship. Every week it's an opportunity to leave the world at the door if we can. Third, let's try to be holy. I think genuine attempts at personal piety is not a bad discipline. Let's try to live more like Jesus. It's not easy, we won't succeed, but we should try. The more we try to live like Jesus, the more the good news gets out there. And the more the good news gets out there, the more the world's ways are undermined. And the more they are undermined, the less effective the world's ways are. Fourthly, name the mechanism whenever you see it. Look for scapegoating behaviour and name it. Do we have an Aboriginal problem in this country, or are we scapegoating Indigenous Australians for the guilt in our own hearts? Do we have a terrorist problem in this country, or do we find the joy of common cause in having someone outside to blame? And be careful about how we answer such questions, lest we only turn to scapegoating the government or John Howard or George Bush. You see, replacing one scapegoat with another is not what Jesus would do. Jesus did not accuse Caiaphas or Pilate for his own death. Only the world accuses. But the message of Jesus, which John reminds us is a message we have heard from the beginning, is that we are to love one another. So let's attempt to live lives that are worthy of our calling, not by following the world's ways, but as spiritual beings. Paul, writing to the Roman Christians, tells us not to follow the rituals or sacrifices of the Jews or the pagans, because they represent the world's ways. Instead, he says, as we heard this morning, worship God in a way that is worthy of thinking beings, by offering your living bodies as a holy sacrifice, truly pleasing to God. Don't model yourselves on the behaviour of the world around you, but let your behaviour change, modelled by your new mind. This is the only way to discover the will of God, and it's the only way to know what is good, and it is the only way to know what it is that God wants, what is the perfect thing to do. May we all discover what is the perfect thing to do today and every day. Amen.